All right. Flip with me to Luke 10. Okay, so just kind of a recap so everybody feels like we're dropping in on where, just kind of what we've been doing in Sunday school. All right, the first, we spent a few weeks and we just kind of set up a framework for how we wanted to think about suffering. We wanted to kind of have all of our questions about what is God doing with trials, with difficulties, those kinds of things. We wanted it to fall into certain categories of what we think. And so the fact that heaven and hell are real and that God's going to reward, punish, take care of the things that happen in this life, that we're not, there's an end to everything, that God's actually got purposes of which he's directing all of our things. And not just purposes for the end, but in light of where he's taking things, we have all sorts of purposes that are happening now. Even things like suffering is really connected to our holiness, right? I mean, you know, that just, we use that, for instance, the old example of patience, that one of the only ways to learn and gain a spirit-filled life of patience is for your patience to be tested. I mean, that's just one example. You can do that with any of the fruit of the Spirit. What does it take for that fruit of the Spirit to grow? Well, you can't practice any of the fruit of the Spirit without relation to other people. So the fruit of the Spirit only makes sense in the context of a church. It only makes sense in the context of real relationships with other people. How do I love? Well, I do love God, and I can, in my quiet time, devotions, whatever, love God, but all those commandments to love relate with the fact that I've got real relationships with the rest of you in this room, that we rub on each other, that we see how you know, life is happening for each other, we come to each other's aid, we speak into each other's life, all of those kinds of things. So it was within this framework where we laid everything. So the last couple of weeks, what we've looked at is, first, how is it that practical, first, if I'm suffering, what do I need to have going on in my life? Well, I've got to have this kind of massive pipeline coming in that is just feeding me the promises of God. That it's just, you know, it's full of all of the Bible truths that just kind of help me reflect, think about, shape, mold who I'm going to be. So if you don't have a way to make that practical in your life, I mean, feel free to ask me, but you've got to have some kind of regular hunger that is just is giving you reason to get up and read the Word again and again and again. And of course, because the Bible we have is actually God's Word, then the whole thing has a whole different way to bring the message to bear. But if you find yourself waking up and realizing, okay, you know, it's really been a month since I've sat down and read the Bible, well, you're kind of at that point where you're not getting the kind of intake it takes just to sustain the Christian's walk of faith. So you've got to have reading, praying the Bible, singing the Bible, those kinds of things. Then last week, the goal was, okay, now thinking in terms of how to get that into each other. How do you look at somebody else who's going through real difficult times and start making the connections of, okay, how do I come alongside them in life and in encouragement and kind of bring that to bear? Today, now the question becomes, okay, how should I think about the fact that there's even too many people in this room right now? If this was all that our church was, just even the group right here, each of you individually would not be able to get to all the other people in all of their suffering as life went on. You don't have enough hours in the day to even be able to do that. So the question then becomes is, how do we kind of make choices along the way that are in wisdom to say, this is how I'm going to come to my brother, to my sister's aid, help them, and then thinking about the world outside of us, how do we come to different places where we can relieve suffering with the people who are outside of even this body? So to do that, we're going to look, you know, one of the things you can see there on point two is this kind of idea of there's a There's a proximity in this circle, a way to think through, a way to grow wise in how we make decisions. So did anybody else not get a handout? Do we need to grab those? Jenny, would you grab a few off that? Oh, Dale, would you see if you raise your hand, I'm going to ask the wonderful Dale Hallman if he'll pass a few out. All right. So that's kind of where we are. I just want to fix that point. So no single Sunday school class, no matter how short it is, feels like we're just jumping into a subject and trying to tackle bit by bit. It's all kind of flowing from different places. So I want to look at Luke 10 for a second, because Jesus just has this way of not allowing any sort of heart self-justification to stand when anybody comes before him. You either come to him with this kind of like wholehearted, be merciful on me, a sinner, teach me everything you know. You have the only perspective that is really true life. And anybody else that kind of comes, you read this in all of the gospel stories, anybody else who kind of comes with kind of a little catch, like, I'm not sure what you can do for me, I'm not sure exactly how you're going to relate, Jesus finds a way to just open them up and demolish that kind of way of thinking. Either the Pharisees, but even people like here in Luke 10, that come to him, which you can't quite tell, are they open-hearted and they really want to learn from Jesus, or are they kind of skeptical of what they want to gather? So Luke 10, so let's start reading. We're just going to read from verse 25 on. Behold, a lawyer stood up to put him to the test, okay? So lawyer is just another word for someone who's really familiar with the Old Testament, and they're able to, because they're familiar with the Old Testament, there's so much law in the Old Testament, they're able to apply it in the different kind of marketplace judicial decisions that are happening. So not our kind of lawyer that, you know, is supposed to defend a different kind of law. They are Old Testament experts, okay? A lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying, Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? Jesus says to him, okay, what is written in the law? How do you read it? And he answered, You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. All right, so he answers. He's got enough Bible knowledge. He's memorized enough that he goes right to Deuteronomy 6 as far as how we're supposed to love God. And he goes right to Leviticus 19 to talk about loving his neighbor. Okay, so he's already got kind of a synthesis. Like, these are the two big things of what the Old Testament teaches I'm supposed to do to live the kind of life that God has told me to live. All right. And Jesus says to him, and he said to him, You have answered correctly. Do this and you'll live. But he, okay, now catch this line, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, Who is my neighbor? All right, so this is the question that prompts the parable of the Good Samaritan, desiring to justify himself. So there's something in Jesus' response, okay, just do that. Do the two great commandments and live, that prompts in this person suddenly the thought of, okay, if I'm going to do those two things, I know that implies more than I really want to admit. And so somehow he thinks he's going to trap Jesus in this who is my neighbor kind of question. Right? And then we get the parable of the Good Samaritan, where hopefully most of you know I'm going to pass over some of it and get down to this end here. This third man, this Samaritan, has compassion on this beat-up guy who's basically left for dead on the other side of the road. Before him, before the Samaritan came, there were two other guys that came that are religious connections of some kind, religious leaders. So this guy picks him up, puts him on his own animal, brings him to the inn, cares for him. Then he gives even money to the innkeeper so that after he leaves, he'll be able to be taken care of. And then Jesus' question is, which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? All right. So now here's the point in verse 37. The guy answers, the one who showed him mercy, and Jesus says, you go and do likewise. All right, so what Jesus has just done in story form is to kind of take this man's, like, he's got all the right excuses for maybe why he can't be merciful to a brother-in-law who's a real jerk, or a child, you know, someone else's kid who's coming to the synagogue who he has grown to resent, or you know, the Gentile who's kind of become a proselyte who hangs out in Jerusalem, but he marvels the fact that he's not studying his Torah as much as he should, and he's just frustrated with him. All of these people that now he's walking by in his daily walks around Jerusalem, somewhere in Israel, and he's frustrated with them. And he could think in his mind, when Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself, yeah, go and do that, he thinks they can't really qualify. They've done something to be outside of the mercy and the compassion that I should show. And he's now built this excuse system, this nice blow-up excuse system, and Jesus has just come along with a needle and popped it by just telling this story about the Good Samaritan. All right? So the point there in verse 37, you go and do likewise. It's Jesus' way of saying there's no one in all of your life whom you should not have compassion on in their suffering. There's no one who falls outside of your desire for compassion. And you know what? When you live in a world as broken as ours, the fact is that even the people on the complete other side of the way you think about finances, or the way you think about, you know, political systems, or the way you think about, you know, even doctrine, as hard as much as you might say that doctrine will lead you to death, thinking that way, there still should be in you some sort of way of which you can be compassionate to that person. And in fact, telling them the truth may be a very compassionate thing to do because you care. Stiff-arming them completely is rarely the way to demonstrate that your heart is open to being compassionate to that person. So this we have all sorts of our own kind of ways that we justify how we begin to act in those kinds of things. I'm sure you guys can think of your own battles where you've come out of a conversation and you replay it in your head for the next several minutes or hours or whatever of all the things you would have said and all the ways you would have handled that conversation and all the ways that you really actually said the thing that needed to be said. And we have ways that which we naturally justify ourselves. And some of those might be right. Some of those are probably wrong. But this parable breaks in and it kind of corrects the heart and says, okay, like, but are you genuinely compassionate? If you really did find that person on the side of the street, would you have enough compassion to immediately go to their aid? So all that to say, what Jesus is doing here is he's giving us a template for always being ready to respond with compassion. Okay? What that means, as you can see there on point one, is that love is the, I don't know if posture is necessarily always the best word, but love is the posture that a Christian takes at all times. Love is the demeanor, it's the mindset. The Christian is always going back to gauge all of our actions and our attitudes and our inner thoughts and our outer you know, thoughts that come out in writing or you know, social media or anything, that it actually is done in love. Now, if you don't know, there can be plenty of times where love is a corrective word or something that stands up in opposition to something else. That doesn't mean it's not loving, but there are plenty of times also where you've read things written by someone that your assumption would be they wrote that without any sort of love for the person they're writing it to, any sort of desire to correct a wrong thought or whatever. They simply wrote it to try and, you know, take that person, knock them down a notch or two. So it's not saying there's not a great place for polemics, for attacking a wrong theology, attacking a wrong way of viewing the world, but love is the posture of the Christian. And so if you can't come, if you can't actually write or say or think those kinds of things, the first step is, of course, do you have a log in your own eye before you begin that process? All right, so that just being said, flip over to Leviticus 19. Because I want you to see that there's places in the Old Testament here where some of this is spelled out really, really well as to how the Israelite community was supposed to put some of these things in practice. All right, so Leviticus 19, look at verse 9 first. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge, neither shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. Don't strip your vineyard bare, neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the sojourner. I am Yahweh. All right, so this church, the previous congregation that was here, they named the church the Edge. It was after this verse, with the idea that the church is kind of a community where those who are typically outside the world's popularity structure, 1 Corinthians 1, not many of you were rich, noble, etc. The church is kind of a gathering place of lots of those people who are on the outside. And so even in the Israelite community, for those that had land, their mindset is supposed to be such a posture of love that they're purposely leaving parts of their field so that people who don't have as much of as them are taken care of. They're just expressing loving their neighbor as themselves. Verse 11, don't steal, don't deal falsely, you should not lie to one another, don't swear by my name falsely, and so profane the name of the Lord your God. Right? So there's loving someone with your words. Verse 13, don't oppress your neighbor or rob him. The wages of a hired worker shall not remain with you all night until morning. Right? So in an agricultural society where everybody gets paid at the end of the day, and if they don't get paid, they don't eat for that day. They have to go and buy, you know, some materials through the marketplace, whatever, in order to make what's enough for that day. If you hold the wages overnight, you're just not loving the people who need it, right? So you can even see in the Old Testament law, there was something that was supposed to prick their hearts to be compassionate, to think love is the posture that you're supposed to take toward the other people within the community. Verse 15. You shall do no injustice in court. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great, but in righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. You shall not go around as a slanderer among your people, not stand up against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. So you're making a judgment about someone. It actually matters whether or not you're fair. Right? You can't, when you hold partialities among you, the New Testament is full of this. You can see what kind of partialities are existing in our community when you start to see divisions rise up in the body. So in James, there's rich and poor. And for some reason, maybe the elders of the church that James is writing to or some of the others are people that are wealthy are finding places of honor where they're putting the people that they have higher esteem for. And they've kind of got a back row seat for the poor. So it's actually breaking in that way against the means of different people. It can break in all sorts of ways. There are people in love with intellectuals. And all of a sudden, PhDs start rolling in through the back doors. And I don't know where our seat of honor is in this place. Wherever that is, all of a sudden, they're getting there, and we're taking anyone who is working a blue-collar job of some way and say, nah, you get over there. That's where you need to be. Like, it's a ridiculous distinction that's growing up within the body that's causing divisions. And even here, I'm just letting you see, love your neighbor as yourself, spelled out in the Levitical law, already it has those things. Much less when Jesus comes with this kind of idea to mind and then brings it to bear on the Pharisees, the lawyer, the scribes, and others, he's just bringing the Old Testament law and saying, it's fulfilled in me, and I'm bringing it to bear on you. How much so, if this is the salvation out of Egypt, that they had and the covenant that they had, how much more are we going to, imbibe and manifest these kinds of things within our own body with such a greater salvation that we have? Okay? Well, just last one there, verse 17. You shall not hate your brother in your heart, but you shall reason frankly with your neighbor, lest you incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people. You shall love love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. So there's where he gets to the actual quote, right? But it's that whole attitude. You're trying to reason frankly with a neighbor because in your heart, all sorts of other things are going on. All sorts of other allegiances are ready to jump out and give you all sorts of reason to want to despise, bear a grudge, hold bitterness in you against this kind of person. All right, so that's general Christian love, right? That's just where we are. So now we got to move to the idea of that's true, but God designed you so that in 168 hours, approximately 8 hours every single night are for you to be in a totally unconscious mode where you don't even get to love. Right? That should teach us humility in that aspect itself. That 8 hours every day, you have no control over whether you continue breathing or not. Right? You don't even know whether you're continuing breathing because you're totally gone. 8 hours every day. Okay? So the rest, the other 16 hours a day, how are you going to get to helping the suffering, relieving, loving, showing this posture toward all the other people in your life? All right? And the Bible talks about it in terms of kind of, you can see on your drawing there, different kind of concentric circles where within each you have specific responsibilities and some of them have priority in your life. Okay? So you've got, in the very middle, you have a family that's given to you to be responsible for. Right? Most parents pick this up by nature as far as they understand that that there are urgencies that go with parenting your kid that are just special and become a higher priority for you. For instance, this building starts to burn, okay? You run back to the nursery and you see that there's a bunch of kids there. You know what? Mark Quick, the first thing on his mind, even though I guarantee you Mark will love all of the kids that are back there, but he's thinking, Julia Gwinnett, do I know where they are? There's no doubt he loves all the kids, but there's a priority that's going to come with family. And you can see this. Let's flip to 1 Timothy. Right? Even though in the body we are considered a family, Paul uses all of the structures that God has built into the world, especially that of family, for giving a way for the church to take care of the different difficulties and the obstacles that it has. All right, so Tony preached on this a little bit, it's been a few months now. So you can go back and you can listen to some of the issues that were going on in Ephesus that were bringing about this kind of neglect. But 1 Timothy 5, verse 8. Let's actually begin the beginning of that sentence. So beginning of that paragraph, verse 3. So honor widows. Here's kind of these shotgun commands from Paul. Honor widows who are truly widows. But if a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show godliness to their own household and to make some return to their parents, for this is pleasing in the sight of God. Okay, so the situation where there's a widow, what's the first way that Paul wants to make sure the widow's taken care of? It's not just a command to Timothy to make sure, hey, Timothy, you go find other deacons in the church and get them out to this widow. But his instruction is, Timothy, you've got to teach the family how to care for each other. So if a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show godliness to their own household. Okay, so that Timothy's job is to go instruct the kids that they have a higher priority of what they might have to give up, even serving in the church, to make sure their widowed grandmother is taken care of. Okay? This is pleasing in God's sight. She who is truly a widow, left all alone, has set her hope on God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day. But she who is self-indulgent is dead even while she lives. So he's making a distinction there. Truly a widow. Now she's all alone. Do you know what? We're going to plug her into the church body and we'll be her, the rest of her family. So you see, he's already made this kind of distinction between if she has family, let it be a higher priority there. If not, the church is glad to be her support system. But if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for the members of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. All right? So Paul is building in, there's a highest priority. If someone in your family is suffering, or all of the responsibilities that go with family, that's where someone should fix their eyes first. And so the Bible itself is setting a sort of wisdom to prioritize. So that that can even go across distance. So some of you have family that lives a long ways away. If somebody out on the street comes in and says, "Hey, I need you to come help me find an apartment, live," and you don't know them really well and those kinds of things, they might be closer in the fact they're right outside the building. But if you're, if my brother-in-law calls and says, "Hey, we need your help moving, into a new house a few hours away," then you can see how I might have a higher responsibility to go take on that task, even though the distance is different. So it's, you start thinking about these categories: distance, time, right? Taking care of family matters eats up huge amounts of time. But if it's a higher priority, you might have to sacrifice the three other things you could do over here for one big family thing because God has placed a higher priority on it. So this is just a way of helping. It's not that all of these won't take wisdom for how to operate, and there won't be times in which you kind of move back and forth through different circles. But it's like a funnel and a filter by which you can kind of judge the different people in your life and who am I supposed to reach out for. It gives you a priority of where you're supposed to be. All right, so there's the first one. Now flip to 1 John. Okay, so I'm calling this one, either you can call it your church membership, your local church. These are people in your life whom you have connected yourself to. So 1 John chapter 3, let's start with chapter 3, verse 4. So everyone who makes a practice of sinning also practices lawlessness. Sin is lawlessness. You know that in order that he appeared, Jesus appeared in order to take away sins. In him there is no sin. No one who abides in him keeps on sinning. No one who keeps on sinning has either seen him or known him. Little children, let no one deceive you. Whoever practices righteousness is righteous as he is righteous. Okay, so he's kind of establishing this before we get down to verse 17, that there is a practice that accords with being connected to Christ. There is a life that goes with, that shows that you have true belief and true doctrine. Okay, now down to verse 16. By this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. But if anyone has the world's goods and see his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Little children, let us not love in word and talk, but in deed and truth. All right, so you can see there that there's now an emphasis on, if you look at your family, your church family, and you're able to watch someone in need pass by and not have that kind of that Luke 10 kind of compassionate, loving posture towards them, then you're disobeying what Jesus is building the church to be. Okay, so hopefully you can see there, both in that verse, as well as the 1 Timothy verse about family, there's a command of which you can sin against. There's a command for you of things that you ought to do, that you should do. If you don't show compassion, if you neglect, in the case of 1 Timothy, you're worse than an unbeliever. That's saying that you're sinning if you look at your family in need and you don't prioritize that. 1 John 3 is teaching, you want to practice righteousness? If you look at your brother in need, if you look at your fellow church member in need, and you deny them that need, then you're failing to practice the righteousness of Christ. You're sinning. You're practicing sinning instead. And 1 John is huge on this, that brotherly love, the love between the members of the church, is so vital because Christ is the one who loved us first. Our whole example is someone looked on us when we were beat up like the guy on the side of the road, and Jesus, the Samaritan, came after us. So our whole ethic of love kind of is the same kind of mindset. So you've got oughts. Things you do that you must do. You must love your family. You must love your church. And now Paul begins to move outward from that. All right, so now we begin to get into the realm of other Christians. Okay, and I want to reiterate again, there's a priority to this, but it does not mean you don't flex in different ways depending on the needs that you're coming along. If you do great at taking care of your family, but someday you actually find yourself walking along and seeing a guy beat up on the other side of the road, and you're like, well, I'm taking care of my family, but you know, I'm not responsible for this guy that I don't know at all because he's way on the outer circle, you're missing the point, okay? That's not what we're trying to work through here. This is the filter of which you say, I've got so many hours of the day, what am I called to be devoted to? Where can I relieve suffering? All right, so other Christians. So 2 Corinthians, this is where, in 2 Corinthians 8, this is where Paul is making an appeal. He wants to appeal, hey, Corinthians, I'm expecting you to get all of your collections together. Remember how you promised to save up money for the Jerusalem church? Your fellow brothers are in need, and I know you as a body promised to do these things, so go ahead and get that collection ready, and I'll be swinging by. We'll pick it up, and it'll blow the Jerusalem church away how much you love them. I just want to remind you of that. I mean, that's what he's going after, and you know, even a kind of a little extra urging of, hey, just want you to know the poor Philippians way up in Macedonia, they blew everybody's expectations out of the water by how much that they set aside. So just Corinthians, let you know you've got a high standard to try and reach there. So 2 Corinthians 8, and I want to look at verse 8 in chapter 8. So I say this not as a command, but to prove by the earnestness of others that your love also is genuine. Okay? Not as a command, but I want you to do this to prove by the earnestness of others your love is genuine for, you know, the Jerusalem church, for me, for the ministry of the gospel that's come to you. And then in chapter 9, verse 7, this is how he finishes this section. Now let's start in verse 6. The point is this: whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. Whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Each one must give as he has decided in his heart, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. All right. So there's no doubt that Paul expects that whatever the Corinthians can do to help the saints of Jerusalem, they'll do. It's completely reasonable that they would look on where the gospel came from, how it started in Jerusalem and came from there to them, and that they should want to give. But it's a may. He's just appealing to their conscience that this is a good thing. This is a may. This is not a command of what they have to do. So there's already a distinction here between Neglecting your family is a sin. Neglecting your local church is a sin. But there's now, you see how the need for wisdom grows as the farther out you get. Now, this is something absolutely you should want to participate in. But these, like, even as, when we talk about, we had such, the last 2 years, the amount of missions pledges is a huge total for where this, for where we had all given as a group, say, even just 3, 4, 5 years ago. And so now, you know, Jeremy and Tony and I are looking at this huge amount of money and saying, okay, how is it best and most wisely distributed? And so we're thinking, okay, we've got great relationships with Trevor Johnson, and we know his heart for ministry. We know some of his biblical fidelity, his care for gospel being taught rightly. And so pouring money into him seems to make sense with the other relationships that he has in the church. And so, you know, like this last year, we sent that huge check of our missions pledge, I think it was $10,000, off to not just gospel proclamation, but to build a barracks of some kind so that students can come out of the jungle and have a place to stay as they go to some of this Bible training, right? It's for some very practical need for something he's doing, but it's a wisdom call. It's something that we think that the church body will agree and the church body loves and prays for the Johnsons, but it's a wisdom call because, do you know what? There's probably 1,000 of those going on across the globe. Which ones do we participate in? Because we can't give to all of them. Resources are limited on that front. Time is limited on that front. And so we're making this decision just hopefully and prayerfully in wisdom. Just like Paul is commanding the Corinthians to do, exhorting them to have what? A cheerful heart. Whatever you're going to give, give. Do it with a cheerful heart. Right? I'm guessing Paul would say the same thing to however you guys think about giving to this local body. We don't actually live under the system where there's a tithe anymore. We talk about tithing to the church, but that's all been fulfilled in Christ. That whole Mosaic system of tithing is fulfilled. Really, the only command for New Testament believers to give is just go give because you've been given so much by Christ. Go give generously. Give whatever that is. If that's 5% and you think that's generous in your heart, give it and be glad. If you think that's 25%, and that's where kind of you feel like you're purposely sacrificing for the benefit of the church, give 25%. There's no kind of numbers that are associated with it. It all becomes that associated with what kind of heart is behind that giving. So, all right, so we have oughts, we have mays, and then of course, you know, this last one is where we get to, especially the parable of the Good Samaritan, is all people in need. Okay? And you've got to have this category because we still live in the world. You have unbelieving neighbors who need you to come across and need you to help with cleaning out a garage, you know, helping you get ready to move, them getting ready to move, you know, sharing barbecues together where, and of course, guess what? Unbelievers go through cancer and divorces and trials and sufferings all the same as we do. And it gives us, of course, opportunity to be in their lives. But this, again, becomes a may. You can't reach all the people in need, but if you can build a relationship and love on the people that do, God does bring into your life, and the ones that are there and interact with them in such a way as to relieve their need, that's fantastic, right? And you can imagine, if you're close to a neighbor who you've been with for years, even if they're an unbeliever, there might be times of which you flex to that kind of neighbor in need and are their biggest lifeline for support. If we've got a widow across the street who's an unbeliever, guess what? I'm probably going to be sending the boys over there all the time to make sure that she's taken care of. And so you can see how wisdom just causes you in love, because your posture is love, to move through these and just use these as a filter of how we think about coming to the aid of people in suffering. All right, so this brings us kind of to our last point. We'll finish up with this. Okay, so 1 Corinthians 15 says, "For I delivered to you as of first importance that which I also received." And then he goes on to describe the gospel. Christ died for your sins according to the scriptures, buried, rose again. Okay, Paul can make a distinction in his mind then between relieving people's suffering and coming to the help in all sorts of different ways and a prioritization on gospel and people being saved forever from the punishment, from the wrath of God in heaven or hell. He can make a priority, right? Paul does this in his life. The reason Paul is going to all the Gentile cities is not so he can just kind of set up little communities that are going to be relief suffering centers. He wants to relieve eternal suffering. He wants to come to their aid by preaching the gospel that tells them, you can't save yourself. Whatever suffering is here, I have a hope that goes far beyond that. So let me tell you of that hope in the gospel. So he writes there, first importance. And he's just making the emphasis that our gospel and thinking of how to get the gospel into any of these relationships and to minister to them is our biggest hope. So, right, Paul would not say for when he comes and tells Timothy, you got to teach those grandsons and those granddaughters to take care of their grandma. She's widowed. It's your responsibility now. Of course, Timothy is going to come to them and say, you take care of all of her needs, those things, but you remind her of all of the other things I've said in 1 Timothy about the doctrine that leads to hope, the truth of the gospel. And the hope is that for anything, whatever, even after you relieve her physical suffering as best you can, you relieve her spiritual stuff. You give her hope and you give her the truth of the gospel. Same thing in the local church. It is great when meals are taken to someone who's in suffering. If you can also bring a word of encouragement that kind of reorients things around the greatest importance, which is making sure we're spiritually taking care of one another, exhorting one another as long as we're able, then that's the hope. That's the greatest hope, even in taking care of each other. The same thing with other Christians. We want to build that barracks because ultimately we want to see thousands of missionaries go into the jungles of Indonesia and preach the gospel to people. And the same with people in need that are outside of any of these circles. So there is a priority of need. We think about the spiritual gospel. We think about the truths of the gospel. And we're thinking, okay, how does this even take priority over anything else that we want to do to help relieve physical suffering? So just a final word then. Right? So if you're helping people, this is kind of a helpful filter by which you run things through. If you're actually the one in suffering, then it's also a reminder that, one, you've got to be able to accept need from others. If you're in this body and you don't have much for family that's coming to the aid here, you need to be willing to accept the kind of care that the fellow members of your body want to give to you. That they want to share their lives with you. So you got to be willing to accept it. And then, of course, if you're suffering, you're also turning your hope in that priority of need, that your final hope is set in the gospel, that God's going to relieve all suffering when we're all pulled out of the grave in the new heavens and the new earth. When we all stand before him with our new bodies, all suffering will finally be relieved. All right, does this make sense? Is there any questions on that? It seems somewhat, as you just walk through those texts, it seems kind of, you know, self-explanatory, but when you feel caught between the little 16 hours you get and you subtract another 8 or 9 day work week or a work day, your number of hours at the end of the day seems to shrivel up really, really quick as to being able to do this. So, but I think it helps bring clarity. Yeah. Well, let's stop there and get ready for worship.